sorry. I may have missed part of the recording. I'm not sure. Anyway, so the... All right, so far for single cause. And then you get to the grown-up version of the problem, which to me is the post-post version. And that's where you recognize that accidents are really duly caused. Just the point that Post made about externalities in general. This is a particular case. It's true. I would not have run into you, pedestrian, if I had really been paying as much attention as I should have been to the driving. But I also wouldn't have run into you if you hadn't been dressed in dark clothes walking by down the side of the street at 9 p.m. in the dark. So your decision and my decision both affect the probability of the accident, and ideally we'd like to give both of us the right incentives. That's the Coasean problem, basically. And then we say, well, wait a minute, now strict liability has this real problem, because strict liability says that when I run you down, we will suppose you survive without permanent injuries, but you've got a hospital bill and some time you missed at work and some pain and suffering maybe, and I got to compensate you for all of that. So your incentive to avoid the accident isn't very great, is zero if the court law really makes you completely whole, which is perhaps optimistic, but at least is much lower. So that the strict liability gets me the incentive, it doesn't get you the incentive, and for all we know, the right way of preventing that accident is for pedestrians to wear white clothes when they're walking around at night, rather than to have drivers pay much more careful attention to their driving. So it might well be that the strict liability will give us the inefficient solution, standard Coasean story, rather than the efficient solution. Everybody happy with that argument? Yeah. So then the next step is to say, is there any way around this? Yes, there's a way around this, and that way is negligence. And that's this, I think, very elegant argument, even though I have some reservations when you finish with it, which says, look, if we have a negligence rule, and if the court knows everything and therefore never makes any mistake about negligence, and if the drivers are all rational and fully informed, how often will people be negligent? Never. Never pays to be negligent. We just demonstrated that 5 minutes ago, that it is always in your interest to take the efficient level of precautions and then not be found liable. If no driver is ever negligent, who pays the cost when a pedestrian is run down? Who else as well? The pedestrian pays the cost, and that means that the driver is being non-negligent because of the negligence rule, and the pedestrian is being non-negligent because he bears the cost. Standard Pigouvian solution, as it were, from his end. Everybody happy with that argument? Now, this obviously gets into trouble once we allow for the fact that courts can't perfectly observe negligence. And one way in which I like to point out what's really going on, the sense in which in one sense it's a very clever solution, in another sense it's a cheat, and that is that we really have two different mechanisms for getting people to do the right thing. One of them is central authority. One of them is somebody says, this is what you should do, now do it, or we'll punish you. And the other is rational self-interest with the right rules. Somebody says, if you do this, this will happen. You decide for yourself whether to do it. All right? The way we're solving the double causation problem here is we're using the first mechanism for the driver and the second mechanism for the pedestrian. The court, in effect, is ordering the driver to take this level of precautions. Anything less than that, we found negligent. So the driver is not really using his self-interest to figure it out. The driver, putting it differently, the argument for the other method, the argument for the self-revealing method, is that the actor has private information about the value to him of doing things which the external controller doesn't have, and he reveals that when we set up a system so he bears the cost. Is that argument clear enough? Well, how the devil does the court know what's negligent? It doesn't know what the value to me is. I mean, it was really important that I be thinking through this interesting economic problem when I should have been paying attention to driving. They can't know that, similarly for anything else. Plotting out a novel scene while I should have been paying attention to the driving. And maybe getting that novel scene will make 100,000 people happy if I write this great novel, and that's worth a slightly higher chance of running you down. Court doesn't know that. So in effect, we're going back to the sort of dictatorial solution for one half. That leaves us with only one problem to solve, one problem we can solve by the self-revealing solution. And one way I like to put it is that I've got an even easier rule for solving double causation. The easier rule is the court figures out what everybody should do and tells everybody if you don't do it, we'll hang you. And in that system, obviously, nobody will ever get hanged because everybody we're assuming is rational and fully informed and all that stuff, and the court makes no mistakes. So everybody does what the court tells them. We're now back with the idealized, you know, centralized control dictatorship system, which has really serious problems. So that's a way of looking at it. And indeed, I actually have an improved version. Because if you really think of, not improved, I may not say that. This is an improved version of a different solution, so I'll come to it later. In any case, so that then gets you to saying, all right, if we have a dual causal kind of accident, if we have strict liability on one party, that party takes the optimal precautions given what the other one is doing, the other one has no incentive except for his own private interest. That's fine if one party is the one that's got most of the precautions to take. If we're pretty sure that the pedestrian's precautions really don't matter very much, and the drivers do, then we're fine with strict liability on the drivers. If we have negligence liability on the drivers, that gives both sides an incentive, but it does not give the driver the right incentive with regard to non-observable precautions. So that rule works just fine as long as the non-observable precautions don't matter. As long as almost all of the important precautions you want people to take are ones where the court can tell whether you're taking them or not. All right. So that's now we say let's keep going. Suppose that the drivers have quite a lot of non-observable precautions, but the pedestrians don't. Suppose we have a case where there are important precautions by both parties. The driver's precautions are ones that the court knows what it's doing and what it should do, but the pedestrian's it doesn't. What's the right legal rule?
Sorry, yes.
Suppose a situation where the drivers have precautions that we'd like them to take that we can't observe, in our sense, where we would like to get the drivers to take their unobservable precautions as well. But the pedestrians, on the other hand, either they are walking drunk, in which case we know they're negligent, or they're walking sober, in which case they're safe. Suppose that was the only thing that mattered, and we can check that with a blood test. So now, what's the right legal rule in that situation?
Strict liability.
Very good. Strict liability with a defense of contributory negligence. That exactly reverses our previous system. Now, we know whether the pedestrians were contributory negligent, so they'll never be contributory negligent. Therefore, the drivers will be strict liable. Therefore, the drivers will take the right precautions. All right? Is the argument clear or not? Yeah.
Is using a presumption, is that sort of along the same lines?
I don't know. Explain to me about presumption.
Presumption is when the court basically puts the impetus on one party to prove something, and otherwise it's going to be the other. If it's... Yeah, basically, usually the way it goes is
burden of proof.
We assume this, if this party violates a preponderance, it's not, then the side has to...
That's a fancier question than I'm answering, but that would be appropriate if you imagine that there are precautions which are not observable but are demonstrable, as it were. If you say, well, look, the court looking at me can't tell me if the right precautions. But if I took the right precautions, I could prove that I did it. All right. In that case, then your distinction would make sense. I hadn't thought about that, but that's an interesting way of looking at it. So, anyway, and then finally, if you imagine the case where, for whatever reason, we're sure that all drivers are careful drivers, and we don't care about the incentives on the drivers, but the pedestrians can be careless in lots of different ways, many which we can't observe, now what's the right rule? Imagine we aren't trying to control the drivers, that for some reason we happen to know the drivers are all perfectly safe, or at least all take the right level of precautions, but we're worried about the pedestrians, and not all of the pedestrian precautions are observable, so our previous solution doesn't work for them. Now what's the right answer? Strict liability on the pedestrians, alias no liability.
Right.
Same thing. Right? That's right. So one of the points which sort of is obvious once you think about it but not at first is that strict liability and no liability are really the same rule. You're just switching who the law is just thought of as starting on. Negligence for who?
Or I guess it doesn't even matter.
If it's strict liability in the autos, the pedestrians have no incentive to take precautions.
Oh, okay. Right. But
all the drivers are already non-negligent.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. You're right. A negligence rule would have the same effect as a no liability. That's perfectly true. Just hire a few more lawyers if you do it that way, I guess. But yeah. Yes. No, that's right. So anyway, that sort of runs through, as it were, the standard list of things. And you can think of, there are obviously other rules you can imagine, which I'm not going to go into because I haven't thought about them enough, about joint, et cetera, joint and several liability and stuff like that. And then there's another interesting alternative, which we discussed briefly, and that's to say they're both liable for 100% each. Okay. And that's the rule which says we fine one of the parties the total damage done, and the other one has to pay for his own expenses. If you imagine that both the car and the pedestrian are injured, then the full bore version of that, the pedestrian is fined for the injury to the car driver is fined for the injury to the pedestrian has to pay for his own injuries, car driver has to pay for his own car injuries. And that has the elegant effect that since both of them are bearing the full cost, each of them independently has an incentive to take any precaution worth taking to reduce the cost. So it's sort of a neat solution, and it has the obvious problem that after the accident, the two get together and say, are you going to tell them no? Am I going to tell them no? Let's go home. That's no incentive to report, and you've really converted it, shifted it out of the realm of tort law towards the realm of criminal law, where you have to have some other mechanism for reporting it. And it's like criminal law, also in the sense the punishment is going to the state, not to the victim, which is one of the differences between criminal and tort law generally. So that gets you to that. I've got an improved version of that system, by the way. Because after all, you can't really assume that the only people who have any effect on accident are the driver and the pedestrian. It could be that the reason for the accident was a good-looking woman was walking down the street and she had tortiously dressed in a provocative way, and that got the attention of the driver and the pedestrian, and the result was the pedestrian didn't see the car coming, the driver didn't see the pedestrian, and there's your accident. So generalize that. And the full rule, the full double liability rule is more than double. The full rule is that whenever there is an accident, everybody within 100 yards of the accident must pay the full cost of the accident. And that results in rather large sums going to the state, so we can cut our income taxes a little bit because they're getting all these fines, and it's going to feel a little unfair when your only connection to the accident was you heard it from the next street over, but nonetheless, that in principle would give you the same result. And, of course, similarly, going back to my other solution, we could have a rule which says whenever there's an accident, everybody within a mile of the accident who did not take the optimal level of precautions will be hanged. And, again, that's just fine as long as everybody is fully informed for the rational reasons. And I think all of those sort of demonstrate in what sense some of these answers are right in one sense and wrong in another, which is the point of examples like that. All right, so next question we looked at a bit is why anybody is negligent anyway, given that we've just shown nobody would ever be negligent. And the answer to that, possible answer, one of them is the party makes a mistake, that he thinks what he was doing was the right level of precaution, but he didn't. That seems reasonably plausible if we back up a little bit from the pure economic world of fully rational people and allow for information costs, uncertainty, anything of that sort. And alternative is the court's making a mistake. And there are categories where not only is the court making a mistake, the court knows it's making a mistake. And those are the cases where the court, in a certain sense, is trying to impose negligence, judging what it knows are unobservable precautions. And the example that I discuss is where individuals vary. So the court says, you're negligent if you didn't take the right level of precautions. What's the right level of precautions? We don't know enough about you to know what your precautions should have been. But we know the average person ought to keep a distance between his car and the car ahead of him of at least, whatever it is nowadays, 10 car lengths. No, it's a car length per 10 miles an hour or some formula like that, and you weren't doing that, and therefore you were negligent. And it's true that we just had a collision yesterday where somebody was keeping twice that distance and yet ran into the car ahead of him. And if we knew enough, we would realize it was because this guy has very slow reaction speed and doesn't pay very much attention and thinks very slowly and can't deal with problems in real time. And he was sort of making up his mind, should I tell him to make sure he didn't make smash? But we can't tune it that finally. And similarly, the guy who was driving less than the required amount, but could stop with no trouble in that distance because his car was, you know, a Ferrari with super brakes and he's a super athlete with very fast reactions, treat him as average too. Court can't get into that much fine distinction. So if the court is saying we define negligence by the average tortfeasor, as it were, potential putative tortfeasor, I guess, you, does it count as a tort if you're not negligent? And just in terms of the language of the law, if I am found that I did run into you, but I was not negligent, and the legal rule is negligence, have I committed a tort which I'm not liable for, or have I not committed a tort at all?
Is there a strict liability tort?
No, the question is if it's not a strict liability tort.
Yeah, so
I haven't committed a tort at all. Right. I just wasn't sure how the language described it. Fine. So the putative tort feature, let's call it that way, to hedge our bets. So in that case, since it's no longer the case that the efficient level as seen by the court is the same as the efficient level as seen by the rational and fully informed driver, now the driver might say it's true by staying, by keeping 10 car lengths away or by staying down to 50 miles an hour, I could persuade the court that I wasn't negligent. But I can drive much faster, come much closer than that, and still have no significant chance of an accident because I'm such a good driver, and therefore the argument would be I have to decide the trade-off between getting home faster and knowing that if there is an accident, I'll be liable. Yeah.
Are we concerned at all with the relative value of the punishment to the tortfeasor, or does that we just still kind of take the average case?
That is, where punishments are money, which in tort they normally are, remember that we're doing all of our stuff in terms of Marshall's approach to efficiency, which is in dollars, not U times. And somewhere in the back of our mind, we realize that there are problems with doing that, but the argument is the best we can do. One way I like to explain that is there's the old joke about the drunk who's looking for his wallet under the lamppost, and you know, somebody says, "Oh, you dropped your wallet there?" "No, no, I dropped it down the street, but the light's worse there." And putting it that way, it's a joke. But a different way of putting the same point is to say we've got two questions. One of them is the one we really want to answer. The other is sort of close to the one we really want to answer. So answering that would get us close, but not all the way. But the second one is much easier to answer. Sense will look the second. And you can argue, I think, plausibly, that even if you're a utilitarian, which not everybody is, but if you believe that the objective is to maximize human happiness, which roughly is what utilitarianism is, you may still say figuring out institutions that will do that is really hard. Because we don't have any good mechanism for revealing how much utility you get from something. Yeah. But we do have a good mechanism for revealing how many dollars something's worth to you, namely offer it to you and see if you buy it. And therefore, if we can create institutions that maximize dollar-measured value, and if dollar-measured value isn't too bad a proxy for utility-measured value, then maybe that's the best we can do. But I am doing it in dollars. Now, you can think of lots of other differences. You can say, well, look, suppose we're talking about criminal law, not tort, and suppose the punishment is a week in jail, that's different dollar values to different people. You might have to think about how to include that as well. Though. I'm not sure.
The question is, if you're concerned about, let's say for some reason there's some tort that only rich people commit.
Right.
You know, whether it be something that sure. You only commit because you have
yes.
a lot of money.
Right.
And I guess in that sense, the relative value of dollars might be less to them
that's
than
right.
to somebody else.
That's
and
right.
when looking into, I guess, the efficient punishment for deterrence,
yes.
In that sense,
yes.
When you look at
we will be getting probably into that question next week. Because what spurred me to work out, I think, correctly the optimal analysis of optimal criminal punishment was precisely the question of whether the rich should pay higher fines. That for many, not for many years, but for some years, I taught law and econ at the beginning of my career at DPI, and students would always object that if you have the same fine for rich person and poor people, rich people can commit offenses, and that's wrong. And I would always say, well, you know, rich people can eat sushi, and isn't that wrong for the same reason? The advantage of being rich is you can do stuff you can't do if you're poor. And eventually I thought about it instead of just answering it. And it turns out the answer is much more complicated. And if you're just still keeping Marshall's approach, still doing it in dollar, because of the differing supply function for offenses, which is what you're talking about, deterrence, it turns out that a correctly calculated optimal criminal rule will sometimes impose higher fines on rich people because the lower fine is sufficient to deter the poor person. You don't need, even suppose the damage does $1,000. If there are some people who won't be deterred, they're crazy or something, so we're going to have to punish them. And all the poor people will be deterred by $100. set the fine at $100. You deter the people you can deter, and the rest of the league can have to try to collect as large a fine. Then you have to set it for a larger amount to the rich. That's the case that's going to fit your intuition in a sense. But it turns out to be more complicated than that for reasons I'm not going to go into. But there are also cases where the result is that you have a lower fine for the rich. And those are the cases where the rich are so hard to deter that it's not worth deterring them, basically.
And I guess because I'm thinking of it, it's not towards central law, but for example, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, Mike Markin, he gets fined all the time in the NBA, like hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yes.
But he cares so little that he still does it, and he also matches that.
What is he doing? I don't know anything in the NBA.
He'll run out of the court during the season owner and yell at the refs, and he'll say bad things about other players in the media. So they fine him all the time. He cares so little that he'll even match the fine and give to charity.
Yes.
Because the guy's multi-billionaire, so $100,000 is nothing to him. Just
nowadays, multi-billionaire is not very rich, but anyway.
Yeah, well, I think it's like $3 billion.
Yeah, that's rich.
Yeah, that's rich. So,
yep.
It just seems that even though it's a large number, it's large for players because they're not as rich as him, but to him, it seems you either find it doesn't change the
people's money. Yeah. Well, we'll get to at least the economic analysis of that problem in the criminal context. It's the same analysis here, it's just that thing where I've done it. So then I guess the next argument that we get to, which is related to your, it's not your question, but it's about the amount of damages, and we then have the problem that if you think of it on a straight Pigouvian basis, you first say, well, fine, the tort damage is equal to the damage. Then we say, wait a minute, not all torts are detected, not all that are detected result in suits, not all so succeed, you may not be able to prove things, even if they're true, therefore the probability, even if I do something that does damage and is tortious, the probability of my paying the damages is less than one. Consequently, my expected punishment is less than the damages, and that suggests that if you really want the Pigouvian solution, you want the damages scaled up to allow for that. And I think it's arguable that in criminal law we do that, but except for punitive damages, which are sort of a special case we'll be getting to in a minute, we don't do that in. And there's the further issue, which I'm going to ignore for the moment, because again, I think we'll get the tools when we do criminal law to see how you would handle it, that litigation is costly, and therefore that means on the one hand that I, the tortfeasor, am not only paying the damages, I'm also paying my lawyer's fee and trying to keep the damages down, which raises my punishment, but it also means that the damage I did by committing the tort includes the litigation fees of both sides. So that makes further complications. So it's sort of in the simple world where you can ignore all of that and assume that you're always caught, always lose the case, and it doesn't cost anything, then the traditional rule of making the victim whole seems to make sense. It's worth noting, by the way, that there is another solution to the dual causal one, which I really didn't discuss, and that's the same solution that I discussed in a number of previous contexts, which is the equivalent of co-insurance. That is an alternative rule as we say, look, in some form we will divide the damages between the two parties so you pay for some of them. And the simplest rule might be strict liability with a very narrow definition of harm. So that strict liability means that I've got to pay for your medical bills but not your pain and suffering, say. And we then say, well, all right, I'm bearing half the cost, you're bearing half the cost. The really important precautions are the precautions that don't cost much and reduce the probability a lot. We'll both do those ones. So we're both going to be a bit off. We aren't going to do the marginal precautions, the precautions that cost almost as much as they do, as the good they do, but not doing those doesn't cost very much, doesn't lose us very much. So that's another possibility. I think that probably a lot of real tort law ends up working that way, whether or not it exists. Anyway, let's now come to punitive damages, which we discussed at some length last time, and basically, the basic history is that they are a very uncommon and somewhat dubious rule until the 20th century, until well into the 20th century, become increasingly common then, and then the question is there a good reason for it? Maybe there isn't. Maybe it's just sort of, it's not like we have a proof that the legal system is economically efficient, even if Posner thinks it is, but it's at least worth thinking, are there plausible arguments for punitive damages? And I ran through six different arguments. One is no, that is, they don't exist. One is they are designed to show moral outrage, and that's a little puzzling as to why we show moral outrage by giving the victim money instead of by using the money to pay the police or something. Then there is the Landis-Posner argument that they are a way of putting back in that probability multiplier I mentioned before, and the trouble is that a deliberate tort might be hard to catch, but a reckless tort you would think would be easy to catch, and therefore that doesn't fit that pattern, because punitive damages are supposed to be for deliberate or reckless torts. There's the Landis, maybe slightly more plausible Landis-Posner story, which is it's in the cases where you aren't sure of the amount of damage and you're not worried about over-punishing because you're pretty sure that the efficient level of the tort is zero. The efficient level of the tort is zero, too much punishment shouldn't be a problem. Maybe. And then I have my two, one of which, again, we'll see more clearly, I think, in the next chapter, but basically has to do with the fact that the efficient rule is not as simple as punishment equal damage done, even with probability multipliers, because we only want to deter a tort if the cost of deterring it is less than the damage, net damage it does. Net damage is damage to the victim minus benefit to the tort. Yeah.
So, would say that the reason why punitive damage is that he would say that we have punitive. So there's no good answer for strict liability, right? But there is for efficient torts and reckless torts.
Right.
And because of that probability is the reason why it's in those and not there.
That is, I presume he would, but the answer is that I have not argued with Posner for well over a decade, and I can't give you a direct answer. However, Posner's book, Economic Analysis of Law, which if you're really interested in this stuff, is worth reading, because Posner knows much more about the law than I do, even if I have doubts about some of his economics. And you can at least see what he says about that. I'm sure it's in the library. If it isn't in the library, I've got multiple copies sitting on my shelf.
You could buy at least thinking that common law is efficient, then that can be efficient.
But anyway, but then my favorite explanation, which as far as I know is original with me, though maybe not, is deterring strategic torts, where the strategic tort is the one where I beat up you to scare off all of them from doing what I don't want to do as a threat. And I ran through the argument for why it makes sense that unless we really fully compensate you, the strategic tort will work, and therefore we want both to overcompensate you so that you won't care if I threaten to beat you up, and to overpunish me because I'm really imposing externalities on all of you and not just him, you directly, and them through the threat that deters them from doing what I don't want. Yep.
I had one thing I wanted to say about the third reason, which is the punitive damages are probability multiplier to compensate, so the probability multiplier rationale. I think you make a really good point when you say that if that were the case, then it should be based on how likely the tort is to succeed.
Not the tort to succeed.
The action to succeed.
Yeah, right.
But I think sometimes, at least in some of the cases in a lot of cases you just can't get punitive damages. Mm-hmm. Like even in a jurisdiction where you can, you can only get it for certain torts.
Yep.
And I think one case where it's defendable under that rationale is that. Like, again, most cases settle, right? Like, 90% of cases, even civil cases, settle.
Yep.
So, if you're trying to make your victim whole, and you have punitive damages as something to hang over the neck of the defense, assuming they did it, then punitive damages basically balance you out to...
Except that if it's really certain the guy's guilty, then he's going to expect if it goes through to lose, and then his settlement is going to be close to the full amount, isn't it?
It's going to be closer, but there's still
punitive damages can push it above the full amount very easily on your argument.
Potentially, but like,
and at least on a probability basis, you see it. At least the business side making some sort of determination about the probability of the chance to succeed and then settling for some sort of that amount. But I see it there. But
so anyway, so that runs through sort of the. And then the next point I think I discussed is why tort damages go to the victim instead of to the state or thrown into the ocean or some other thing you could do with them. And the disadvantage we've already really been running through, which is it reduces the incentive of the victim not to be a victim. The obvious advantage is it gives them an incentive to report the tort. He's the person in the best position to take legal action, to invoke the legal system. He knows he's been run down. With any luck, he knows who did it. Furthermore, he's the guy who has the evidence. He's the guy who has the incentive because he wants to deter torts against himself. This is the point we'll get into later, the idea of private deterrence as a private good rather than a public good, which exists when potential wrongdoers know whether or not your behavior is such that it's a bad idea to wrong you. And so there, it makes some sense to pool all of those things in one guy by saying that he has the right. But as I say, it does have the problem not only of reducing his incentive to prevent it, but also of making him a less credible witness, because after all, he's testifying in his own interest, which is a potential problem because he may be the best witness. So we then go on to what I think I just started to do last time, which is product liability law. And there, again, the problem is joint causation, because at least in many cases, the reason something bad happened is some combination of the characteristic of the product and how it was used. So the, and I don't know if I mentioned to this class, I remember mentioning to another class in a similar context, that you may find all of this very puzzling, but you have to understand that there was a time in the very distant past, a little after the Stone Age, when Coke bottles were made out of glass. And when a glass Coke bottle breaks, shatters from the pressure of the carbon dioxide, it can really do damage. I doubt that plastic can do a little, but not very much. So that's sort of the context. The Coke bottles are real cases. It's not, I use it as an example, but there really were cases of exploding Coke bottles and of lawsuits coming out of them. And then the joint causation, we're back where we've usually been. If you assume that we limit ourselves to either strict liability or no liability, and we can go a little farther than that in a minute, but start out with those two alternatives, then strict liability gives Coke an incentive to make its bottles carefully whenever doing so on net saves, but it does not give the user a incentive to make sure that he doesn't use the bottles in a dangerous way, that he doesn't let them really get hot and shake them up, and that if he does those things, he wears glasses so his eyes won't be injured and stuff like that. And no liability, caveat emptor, which is in some sense a traditional rule, goes the other way. It doesn't give Coke an incentive, but it gives the user an incentive. One argument for that is that Coke may have a reputational incentive, that when you hear about somebody injured by an exploding Coke bottle, you say, well, maybe I better buy Pepsi the next time. Those Coke people don't make their bottles very well. And if you were really fully informed, if you could assume the consumer actually knew the ex ante probability that a Coke bottle would explode, in that case, the consumer is going to allow for that and what he'll pay for Coke bottles, and Coke then has an incentive to make them efficiently safe. Now, in principle, you could reverse that and say, well, if Coke knew how this particular user was going to use Coke bottles, they could price them higher to risky people and less to safe people, but it's an awful lot harder for Coke to know about each individual customer than for the customer to know about each customer to know about the single Coke. So that's sort of, it's a pretty straightforward argument. I go through it in the book. I've just gone through it here. I don't think we need it. And then that suggests that whether you want emptor or venditor depends on who you are more concerned with putting incentives on, which you think is the greater risk. With the further addition that the one big advantage of caveat emptor is that you don't have to have a lawsuit. That there's sort of should be some presumption for letting losses lie where they fall, just because that's the easiest thing to do, the least costly thing if you have to prove anything. There are then a couple of other possibilities. One possibility, again, is the co-insurance version, where you say Coke will be liable, but liable for less than the real damages, and therefore each party has an incentive to take a good deal of precautions, even if not all the ideal precautions. And another possibility, which I think I mentioned briefly in the book, I don't remember how much, is you use negligence. You could try to say, either can we prove that Coke was negligent? That's probably going to be pretty hard if you think about how do you figure out what precautions have what probability. But you might say, well, look, Pepsi's got their rate of exploding bottles down a tenth as high. They're doing X, Y, and Z, testing their bottles, so maybe you should. You could pretty easily imagine a contributory negligence theory in which we say anybody who shakes a glass Coke bottle after leaving it out in the middle of the summer for 3 hours was negligent, especially if he didn't wear glasses, so he loses. But you could certainly imagine approaches along those lines. Any questions so far? Yes.
Yeah, I just remembered the question that I had.
Yes, very good.
Class. So it was about using tort as compensation.
Yes.
So I think I remember from tort law one specific instance where I could see it being kind of important, which is that I don't think insurance is allowed to indemnify like an intentional tort. Like if someone right. punches you on purpose, their judgment can't be
yes.
Right.
Yes,
so
that's right.
So in cases like that, where you really don't want to encourage people from committing, like
that's a reason not to let people insure against tort judgments.
Right.
And it's not entirely clear that it's a good reason. Let me think about that for a minute. Because the counter argument would be that the insurance company knows this too. The insurance company knows that insuring will increase the risk if you're doing it. They will therefore, in the price of the insurance, include that increased risk, because when you do it, they're going to have to pay off for your damages, and therefore you're getting... I ought to think about that more carefully.
Well, let's say we live in a culture, which I think we do, where we're not comfortable with selling people insurance to like hurt other people. Like we just don't want to have
yes.
that as a matter of public policy in some larger
right.
sense.
Yeah.
And I think that's the case. So in that situation, if you want victims to be compensated, that
they can have their own insurance.
Yeah,
and that's the argument I'm going to do next. My basic argument is that tort provides very bad insurance. And it does that for two quite different reasons. The first is that whether you want to be insured doesn't depend on whether the injury is tortious. So that if I want to be insured against medical injuries that are large enough to be significant compared to my wealth, then I would need insurance against them. I'd like that to include not only being struck by cars, but being struck by lightning too. Well, you know, despite my efforts to take legal action when the weather gets bad, we really can't sue God when we're struck by lightning. Or at least we can't collect. And therefore, it makes more sense to say, instead of saying a quarter of the bad things that can happen to us will be covered by tort law and three quarters by insurance, it would seem to make sense that as far as insurance is concerned, the sensible thing to do is to just cover all of the bad things that we think need insurance with insurance. Now, if we have tort law as well, we might then have subrogation. We might say, all right, if I am injured and my medical costs are paid by tort damages, I'll pass that on to my insurance company, which has already paid my medical costs, just because I don't want to buy double insurance. It costs less if I do it this way. But it's hard to see why you would... The question I'm really asking, it, which goes back to my value of life discussion in a much earlier chapter, is do you want, in deciding on tort damages, do you want to think of their purpose as insurance and then set them at the level appropriate to that? And if you did that, first you would probably want strict liability rather than negligence, because after all, you need the money just as much when I wasn't negligent. Not your fault in the normal negligence case, just whether it's his fault. And you would want to set the damages. You would probably not want damages for any minor costs. You would only want to start having damages when the costs were sizable compared to the wealth of the victim. Doesn't sound like. So it makes more sense, I'm arguing, to use your tort damages as deterrence and then to let people simply get whatever level of insurance they think is optimal.
So if someone were to say, well, it's not fair for tort victims to have to buy insurance, why should
yes.
the impetus be on them? Your response would be that it's just overall more efficient and therefore everyone saves in the long term.
And it provides them other things.
Okay.
And that after all, they're still getting the tort damages, assuming the legal system makes the other person liable, so their insurance will be less expensive because in some circumstances the insurance company will get the money back from the court damage and therefore will be willing to sell them insurance more cheaply because they won't have to pay as many. So they're still getting the tort damages. There's a second problem, though, which is maybe a little less obvious, but I think at least equally serious, and that is that even if they covered the same thing, there's a fundamental reason why tort would be a more expensive way of providing insurance than insurance is, and that's the incentive of the parties who are paying. That if you think about the insurance company, on the one hand, it doesn't want to be fraudulently collected from, so it wants to be skeptical enough so that it mostly will only pay when it really owes the money. But it doesn't want to have the reputation for being too skeptical because nobody will buy its insurance. If they say, look, yeah, it was no one's fault, but it was an insurable accident, but my God, it took me a year and a half to wrench that money out of the insurance company, that's not the insurance company your friends are going to want to buy insurance from. But on the other hand, if I say, yeah, the guy ran into me, and I sued him, of course, and it took me a year and a half and $15,000 of lawyer's fees to get that damn tortfeasor to pay up, that's just the reputation the tortfeasor wants. because the result is that the next guy he runs into is going to say, to hell with him. What you usually do if you run into a man uninsured motorist, for example, and you say it's going to cost me more than it's worth to try to make him pay, I'm going to swallow it myself. So therefore, between a system where the guy you're getting money out of in some sense wants to pay, it's in a limited sense, obviously the insurance company doesn't like paying out money, but they want the reputation of being willing to pay, and the case where they want the reputation of not being willing to pay, it seems to me the latter leads to a whole lot larger costs of collecting than the former. Yes?
I'm wondering if you've looked into system where they've at least first part of negligent tort damage they replaced with a insurance system. Granted, it's a national insurance system.
So it's a version of no fault.
Right.
And there is a literature which I am by no means up on no fault. I think mostly in the U.S., maybe in New Zealand as well. And there seem my impression is there is some disagreement as to whether no fault does or does not result in more accidents. And the obvious argument that it would is that you're eliminating the incentive to drive carefully because you're not going to have to pay damages. And the counter argument is, yeah, but you're still, when you drive carefully, you might kill yourself. That's enough of an incentive, so the extra incentive isn't very important. And I do not know. And I know that there is such a literature, and in fact, Bill Landis's wife, I think, wrote one of the articles, as I remember, but I don't really know that literature.
In the situation you're talking about, insurance, it would be that each individual would pay for the insurance themselves.
That's what I'm... And the insurance is not against torts. The insurance is against serious medical injury or something like that, or house fires, or, you know, the... You know.
Well, sorry. Another problem I'm having in a lot of ways, accept what you're saying about tort victims buying insurance.
Agreeing is a waste of time. Tell me about parties disagreeing.
Okay, right. But I still have a problem with, like when I think about how insurance works, I know that they're going to assess the likelihood.
Right.
They're going to try to put you in a group.
Right.
It just seems really... It seems like it would be very, very problematic in ways that exceed even any other kind of insurance to try to make risk assessments and peg people in terms of their...
I'm not talking about victims. Just a minute. Okay. Why is figuring out the overall chance of your being injured any greater when you're considering the chance of being in an auto accident than the chance of being struck by lightning? From your standpoint, those are both random events.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. All right. So let me go. Oh, by the way, one thing I should have mentioned and do mention in the book, going back to product liability for a minute, is the possibility of freedom of contract, of saying if we will have some default rule. The default rule is either caveat emptor or caveat venditor, but you can contract around it so that if the default rule is caveat emptor, the seller can offer a guarantee, as sellers often do, of course. And if the default rule is caveat venditor, the buyer can sign a waiver agreeing not to sue. And those are both possible ways. And then, in order to argue against that, you have to argue not only that the buyer is poorly informed, but he doesn't know he's poorly informed, in a sense that he therefore doesn't see the advantage of whichever rule you think is.
Sorry.
It's all right. I'd rather respond to questions than repeat what's already in the book.
I rarely disagree with you, but to the point where I actually want to follow through.
Very good.
I'm asking so many questions. Okay, so the obvious distinction between getting struck by lightning and by getting struck in the face intentionally by somebody is, one, it's being imposed on you by another person.
Right.
Right? In either case, let's say you can't take precautions more than a certain amount of precautions.
Right.
And the probabilities are always going to be the same for everybody, let's even say.
Yep.
But you're still, in one case, I guess this is like the one time where I just feel like fairness has to start playing into it.
But I don't understand, because the question is not whether the person who strikes you should be liable.
Right.
The question is whether, in deciding how liable he should be, it should be on the grounds of what the optimal insurance is or what the optimal deterrence is.
Right, okay.
And again, let turn it around. Guy strikes you in the face. He does the medical. I mean, as it happens, you're fairly well off. The cost of the medical treatment, you're retired, so the cost of being out of work is zero. You like reading books, and you can read books in hospital. The cost of the medical treatment is $3,000. That's all right. Your assets are $300,000. You wouldn't insure against that risk.
Sure.
So if the basis for tort damage is insurance, you wouldn't be liable. Whereas if the basis is deterrence, he would.
But, okay, so I guess what I'm really getting at is, if you're insured against being struck by lightning, pretty much everyone in the world is going to have the same insurance rate, right?
Right.
If you're insured against getting struck in the face, it would probably have to be pretty much the same thing, right? I mean, unless you're like a bar.
I bet that women are less likely to receive damaging strikes to the face than men.
Okay.
I might be wrong. Well, and I bet that 21-year-olds and 19-year-olds are a whole lot more likely than 55-year-olds.
Lightning too. I mean, insurance companies are really good at that.
They are, but there's a point where somebody has a very low probability of getting punched in the face.
Yes.
And then they do get punched in the face.
Right.
And they didn't buy the insurance because the rate was way too high for them and not too high for somebody in the inner city. And then they...
But the insurance wasn't against being punched in the face. The insurance was against being injured. By anything.
Well, the insurance was for intentional...
No. My initial point was that one of the things wrong with tort as insurance is that it only covers a very small subset of injuries. And that your reasons for wanting to be insured don't depend on whether or not the injury was tortious. So therefore, if you get insurance, you'll get, medical insurance or home insurance or something of that sort.
Okay, so it's actually so broad that the averages do work out.
Well, I mean, around different people are going to be different. I mean, that's the issue of insurance.
It's more likely to work out than if everybody bought it.
All I'm saying is that you seem to be imagining the people are insuring against a particular tort, when part of my argument for why you don't want to think of tort damage as insurance is they only insure against a particular tort, and that's not what the customer wants to do. All right, let me go on to another point, which I think is actually moderately important, and which is related to this whole question of whether you know what a Coke bottle is worth, according to how I view this to explode. And that is that we've really been talking so far the language of moral hazard, even though we haven't called it that, the question of whether they take optimal precautions. But the other issue that arises in all of these cases is adverse selection. And in this case, the question is, should I buy the Coke bottle? And you can reasonably say that if I don't know the chance of its blowing up, and if the rule is caveat emptor, I don't know what the Coke bottle is worth to me. So if the Coke bottle, if a Coke absent explosion problems is worth 51 cents, and it's sold for 50 cents, I don't know whether the risk of the insurer of the explosion is enough so that I shouldn't buy it because it's really only worth 49 cents after subtracting that, or so that I should because it's still worth 51. That's an adverse selection. The point that's important, though, I think, is that as long as the difference made by the asymmetric information is small, the efficiency costs are very small. That is a second order effect. Because if we're talking about a case, imagine that we're going to start out not knowing the value of Coke, putting aside the explosion. But Coke sells for 50 cents. And the cost associated with exploding Coke bottles is something between 0 and 2 cents, but I don't know what it is. As long as the value to the Coke is more than 52 cents, it doesn't matter how much. It doesn't matter for adverse selection how much, because I'll buy it anyway. Make sense? If the value of the Coke bottle is less than 50 cents, it doesn't matter because I won't buy it anyway. So that means that the adverse selection problem only comes when the difference between price and value is smaller than the range of possible unknown effects. And that means that the smaller the range of possible unknown effects, the fewer cases are affected. All right, that's my first order effect. Furthermore, if the range is smaller, but 0 to 2 cents. If it is the case that I think it's 0 and it's really 2 cents, and so I buy for 50 cents a Coke bottle, which I enjoy at 51 cents, but was really only worth 49 because of the explosions, I'm only losing a penny. Right? So the smaller this effect is, not only the fewer cases where it has any effect at all, but in the case where it has an effect, the smaller the inefficiency resulting. And that, it seems to me, implies that one ought not to worry about that problem for any small effects. And I would argue that the Coke bottle almost certainly is a small effect, that the chance of exploding Coke bottles, even when they were glass, was low enough so that it's not going to make the difference of whether you want to buy a Coke unless you're very close to the margin of buying a Coke. Now, And that then also is related to the whole issue of warnings, which is, of course, a very lively issue in terms of current product safety kinds of law, because that implies that the adverse selection part of warning, the warning as a way of getting you not to buy it if you shouldn't buy it, ought to be ignored except when the cost that's being revealed by the warning is a large one, probabilistically large. Now, I admit I'm biased in this, because I am continually irritated when I open up the instruction manual for something and discover the first 24 pages of it are devoted to unlikely things I might do that would get me hurt with this product. And when I look, when I observe a tube of glue, and the tube of glue has no information at all on how to use it, because the whole tube is taken up with safety warnings. So I'm prejudiced. I find this sort of pattern irritating. But there's also a real argument here, which is that unless the warnings are warning against something which is a sizable risk relative to the value of the product to you, then it probably isn't worth putting them on, it probably isn't worth your reading them, and so forth. Now, that's separate, of course, from the warning as a way of keeping you from misusing the product, so that if what the warning is saying is not there is a one chance in a thousand this bottle will explode, but rather do not take this bottle out of refrigeration in the summer more than half an hour before you're going to drink it because the pressure might blow it up. That's useful, but that's the moral hazard. In effect, I mean, I guess they call it moral hazard. It's informational, but it's still getting me to take the right precautions, not getting me to make the right buy, not buy decision. All right? And that then gets back to my horror story about polio vaccine, which you've already read. Yeah.
I guess this analysis would seem to suggest that we should expect relatively low damages in these sort of rare product liability cases. And in fact, we see large settlements because of the fear of large punitive damages.
Or class action.
Or class action suits.
Yes. Although presumably, I guess to make a class action suit, you'd have to be able to show that lots of other people were injured by exploding Coke bottles too. And once you, if you really believe that only one out of 100 will sue, then there's something to be said for large damages when somebody does sue. And that goes back to my probability multiplier and the way of doing it. All right. So let me go on finally to Vosburg v. Putney, the eggshell skull case, which is interesting to me because it plays into my analysis of the evidence for and against Posner's conjecture. And the people understand the nature of the case and the nature of the result, and you really have two arguments. The one argument says the issue is if the tort victim is unreasonably vulnerable, eggshell skull, so you did something you should have left a slight bruise, but instead you cracked his head, and he had to go into the hospital for 6 months. Should you be liable for the foreseeable damages? Should foreseeability come into damages as well as liability, or should you be liable for the actual damages? And the rule of Vosburg v. Putney is actual damages. And the argument in favor of that is to say that you're never going to get sued if you hit the guy on the head and nothing happens, because boy, does he have a skull. Not going to get sued at all. So therefore, if we do it by the foreseeable damages, unless the court is somehow clever enough to allow for who won't sue, I will end up paying average damages for the vulnerable people and for the average people, and no damages for the tough people, as it were. Now, I'm not sure how strong an argument it is. You could say, well, if the court's going to set it, they should set it allowing for that, so that I'll pay the right average. But then, in any case, the counter-argument to that is the argument which says, but wait a minute, we have always two people whose actions effect is happening. The guy with the eggshell skull can do lots of things to try to prevent this accident, ranging from telling everybody, look, you ought to know, I had a concussion 2 years ago and I'm really vulnerable, so please be careful around me, to wearing a bicycle helmet or equivalent all the time, to not participating in any sports where you might have all sorts of choices you can make. If you're talking about a very rare condition, it looks as though having the one person in 1,000 who is vulnerable bear some costs to prevent it is a more sensible way of preventing than having everybody bear the costs on the chance that you might be the one in 1,000. So that's the basic counter-argument. And then the point that I find particularly telling is that you've got this other case, the one which I call the Himalayan photographer, which actually I think involved a cow, if I remember correctly, but I'm not sure. I cite the case in the book, which took the opposite position in a different context, which said that when I fail to take proper care in developing films and don't know that they're extraordinarily valuable films, I'm only liable for the normal and not the extraordinary costs, and that is justified on just the argument I just gave. And then my complaint about Posner is that he makes both arguments in different places of the book, applied to different sorts of cases, and at least when I last read the book, it didn't seem to occur to him that, economically speaking, they were the same case. And that he was therefore demonstrating how once you know what the law is, you can always prove it's efficient by picking your argument. Not always, but often. Anyway. So, let me go on to the final bit at the end of that. Well, not the final, or semi-final. And that's the lump sum versus the attainments. And can people see what are the advantages to each of those? That's reasonably clear that the lump sum, you don't have to keep going back to the court. The litigation costs are less. You have more incentive to try to minimize the problem thereafter because with the continued payment, if you strain heaven and earth to retrain in some field which doesn't need your legs because your legs were crippled by an accident, well, now you're not losing your wages anymore, so now they don't owe you as much damages next year. So if we make it a lump sum for we expected cost, then you have all the incentive to do everything thereafter. The problem. That's an argument for lump sum. And the counter argument is the one that I give with this story, which I came across somewhere or other, which is that the lump sum is an invitation to fraud, because once you've gotten the sum, you can now, on one excuse or another, ameliorate really fast if it wasn't really as serious as you claimed, and you have the money. So those are arguments for both directions. All right, well, I was going to quote the bit from Blackburn from Fletcher to the Rylands, which is on the book, but I'm not going to bother, and I will let you think for yourself of whether it's obvious, whether that ought to be a negligence or a stretch liability when you're going past places where people are lifting and lowering heavy weights in a port or something, and once in a while they drop them on somebody, usually a safe, of course, on someone who's just chatted with his friends. All right, that covers it as far as I can see. You will notice that the weather has gotten better, so legal actions, it takes a little while, but if you threaten enough, you can get what you want.
Where did you get the Lourdes story from?
The what?
The Lourdes.
God knows. You know, I wrote this book a long time ago. I've been accumulating material for teaching for 40 years, roughly. So the answer is the good story, and I'm almost certain I didn't invent it. And you've got Google. You might, with luck, be able to find it. You might even be able to find the original source.
Remember the plaintiff wrote my paper if it was okay or
I haven't read it.
Oh, you haven't read? Okay.
I just I had it in that. Yeah. I noticed it was there when I took out my notes today to see what was there. Do it. I'm sorry, but. No.